Registration for Ottawa's Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest is now open, happening May 3rd, in memory of the great Tom Naumann. It's a non-competitive, family-friendly way to identify and pick morel mushrooms on a guided hunt. Purchase your tickets now at visitottawail.com.
Today is Wednesday. It's April 16th, 2025, and it's 2:45 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen for my radio show weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, multimedia journalist and contributor to many platforms.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Substack history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, where you can find my opinions about just about everything.
We are listening to Eric down the phone line. There are some technical issues across the country today with some of the platforms that people like us use to record these podcasts. But Eric, we hear you loud and clear, so you're ready to roll?
I'm ready to roll.
Dexter Reed. Were he alive today, and had he not shot first, he would probably be in line for a large settlement with the city of Chicago. He was pulled over for reasons that still aren't clear and did not cooperate with police when they asked him to roll down his window and get out of his car. According to the city's Civilian Office of Police Accountability, the 26-year-old shot first. He hit a Chicago police officer. And officers then fired 96 shots at Reed, hitting him 13 times. It is hard to see the justification for the initial traffic stop. And why were the officers acting so aggressively? If they had shot him once and he survived, the video would have been a payday for Dexter Reed and his family. But based on what actually did happen, it seems preposterous that a $1.25 million settlement was on the line. If you just looked at the way the police acted, in my estimation, that was wrong. And that's the sort of thing the city often has to pay for. But the city shouldn't be paying his family for something that happened as a result of him shooting first at a police officer.
Well, obviously it would be fiscally prudent for the city to pay that $1.25 million. News reports have suggested that it's going to cost them $4 to $5 million in outside legal fees just to defend the case that the Dexter Reed's family has brought against them, so that it would make sense for them to have it go away. As a matter of public interest, I think it's very important that this case go to trial and all the facts be fully aired out. It is unclear, as you said in your intro, why it was the police decided to pull over Dexter Reed. First, their thought was, well, maybe he had didn't have his seatbelt on. And I did a frame-by-frame reconstruction of all the video from that event, including some surveillance video from a distance, and you can see that there's no way that it was a seatbelt violation. They couldn't have seen that. So what was it? Was it tinted windows, or was he just driving while black? And so there's that question that has not been answered. And the exact sequence of events in which he allegedly fired, apparently he did fire and shoot a police officer in the wrist or the hand or the arm. I can't remember where it was, but it was a non-fatal injury. And then there's the question of 96 shots. Was that overkill? Not to make a play on words, but did the police overreact there? And it's a question that it's as a matter of public interest, this should be aired out in court, and it's going to cost more money that way, almost for sure. Certainly for sure, it's going to cost more money. But I think it's the right thing for the city to do, to say let's air this all out.
What that assumes, Brandon, is then that what happened after he shot first, the police had carte blanche. They could do whatever they want to defend themselves and shoot back.
It's a really tough case, because I think when it comes to, you have two issues at play here. You have the settlement itself and sort of the larger issue that goes beyond Dexter Reed, of this issue of pretextual traffic stops, or this idea of pulling somebody over for a minor violation in hopes of trying to get them for a gun or drug possession or something more serious, which is what this appears to have been. And I think that has to be separated from the settlement discussion, because when a city council and aldermen have to consider financial payments out to a family, they do have to consider the fact that Dexter Reed did shoot at police officers. And they have to think, from a city, we can't reward shooting at police officers. I think that would be kind of the message, something they'd be giving by awarding such a large amount of money there. That still means, though, that there needs to be some reform and examination of the reason Dexter Reed was pulled over in the first place. But Dexter Reed's actions in that moment weren't the best actions to take. Now, is it fair to blame him for 100 shots being fired? Is 100 shots excessive? Absolutely. But if Dexter Reed wouldn't have fired those shots, he'd probably still be alive today.
Of course. I believe that. Well, so
you can't fire a police officer.
So is it stop the tape before the first shot is fired? Should there be some penalty or payment for what happened there? Should there be some penalty to the police officers, some payment by the city for the fact that he was pulled over and treated so aggressively?
And I think that part gets tough because we don't have all the facts or clarity on why he was pulled over. Mm-hmm. We've heard two different things. We've heard that it was tinted windows. We've heard that it was seatbelts. We don't have a clear answer there. And so I think what Eric said, we got to get the court bearings here and get the facts out there. Maybe they can reconsider this settlement. But without the facts there, I think it makes it tough to really make a ruling on why he was pulled over in the first place.
The COPPA investigation isn't even finished yet. We literally have no idea of anything except what we were told in the press and what we could see in the video. We don't know anything else yet. So to be offering a settlement of any kind in a situation where the victim, while we obviously are all horrified by what happened to him, nonetheless, he shot at the police officers first, and there's no question about that. There's absolutely no wiggle room.
But the city can't tolerate that kind of behavior by the police before the first shot was fired. You can't just
yes and no. I'm gonna agree with Brandon there that basically yes, it was a pretextual stop, but you have to separate that out because a pretextual stop, while it's controversial at this point in time, especially, it's not illegal. It's not unconstitutional. The police were not ipso facto breaking any rules by pulling him over for pretextual, as we're calling it, reason, which we don't even know what that was at this point in time. So I just don't see how that complete unknown can factor in when it's not automatically illegal.
Yeah, and there may be an issue here with this particular team, this particular SWAT team, or however you refer to them. There were five officers, I think, involved with this. There may be an issue with their history that the city does not want to see revealed, or that some in the city don't want to see revealed. But what happened was that this settlement did not pass through the City Council Finance Committee. The Finance Committee voted, I think, 15 to 12. Kate, you probably know the totals, but it was something like that. Against the settlement, and there was a lot of statements from people saying just what John said, which is you can't reward somebody who shot at a police officer. But I'm wondering whether somebody involved in these negotiations thinks, oh boy, we're going to have to look at this SWAT team's record and a number of people they pulled over, and there are going to be witnesses called who said I was a black person driving down the street and I got pulled over for no reason by these goons, and if that. That could easily sway a jury, and they could say, well, you know what? Yeah, he fired first, but these guys were in plain clothes, and they looked like they might have been threatening, and this guy had a reasonable fear. Dexter Reed had a reasonable fear that something would happen to him, so he made a bad decision, but he didn't deserve to get ventilated. I don't think that that's true. I think that John's right when you say you fired a police officer, all bets are off. But the city may not want to dig into this muck that may be pulled up from the bottom of the pond when they start litigating this case.
That could be. And it's just another example of the fact that we literally know nothing about it at this point.
What more do you need to
know?
They're
going for the short-term benefit of less money now, when the long-term benefit in the long run could not be a benefit but a cost of incentivizing still more people to automatically bring lawsuits against the police.
I saw, too, that the expected settlement would be $5 million and the legal costs would be $3 to $4 million. What do you think would happen if it went to trial? Brandon, do you have a guess on that? Like, I wonder how a jury would assess the police and Dexter Reed? And would they give the family more than $1.25 million or any money at all based on what the police did before the first shot was fired?
Yeah, I think that's something to consider here, because you got the legal costs as well as the fact that this may actually go up. And so it's interesting because the city, some of the aldermen and city council members are talking about how they got to really think about financial decisions and what's best financially for the city. I go back to the point about the whole pretextual stops. If you reform a lot of these practices, you end up saving money for taxpayers long term. We already pay as a city among the highest amount for other cities when it comes to police misconduct settlements. We had in 2024 $175 million to settle cases. That's obscene levels of money there that could be avoided if we just were to follow a consent decree, make meaningful police reform, and change some of these outdated and ill-conceived practices that police are doing. And so that pretextual stop there may end up costing us more money in the long run than what this alone would have cost.
There's also a question in my mind as to what the police did after they pulled him over. It didn't seem like they knew how to calm the situation down. It felt like they escalated it from the clips that I've seen, that they really came on strong. And I know you've got to take charge at a traffic stop. Police always have to take charge of a situation. But under those circumstances, there may be at least something to be learned from how the police behaved, how they approached the car, how they surrounded him, how he may have felt. There's an issue there, and a jury might consider that. I also want to point something out about the delay in finding out things about this, that it was 4 years ago last month that police officer Eric Stillman shot Adam Toledo in that celebrated case down in Little Village, a 13-year-old boy who was running away from him with a gun in his hand. And we still don't know what happened there. We still haven't had a COPA hearing. We haven't had the results of any investigation. There's still a lawsuit outstanding. I think, as I last understood, Officer Stillman is still on desk duty. And so the delay in finding out what actually happened in these situations and in subjecting them to public scrutiny is really unconscionable. I mean, that was a very high-profile case. The Dexter Reed case was high-profile. Let's get the information out there as quickly as possible and have what we learn from it, then we can apply going forward. But this idea that, I mean, it's like I say, it's been 4 years since that happened.
Did the city settle with Adam Toledo's family?
No, it was going to go to trial in November, and it didn't. And I have been able to figure out why it hasn't gone to trial yet. But that case is still pending. And I don't, again, it just feels to me like the city drags its feet. Everybody drags their feet. And the public needs to know. And if we're interested in the cause of police reform, we need to get the facts out there.
Aldermen from plenty of high crime neighborhoods also voted against making this settlement, including Pat Dowell, who is the head of the Finance Committee and a Johnson ally. David Moore, who is the leader for trying to keep Spot Shotter, for instance. So it's a diverse group of aldermen who did not think it was right to be paying off the family of a victim who shot first at the police. Also, I think I would just correct the impression that some people still seem to have, and which was voiced by Alderman Burnett and Alderman Mitz, that Dexter Reed did not know that he was being stopped by police officers. Even the city attorney who was arguing for this settlement admitted that they were clearly identified wearing CBD police vests with clearly displaying their badges. We all really watched that video very many times. Eric, of course, did a real shot-by-shot analysis of it, but we all watched it very, very carefully when we did the podcast on it last year originally. And there was no doubt in my mind that they were police. They were obviously police. He knew they were police.
More of the Mincing Rascals coming your way. But first, this from our sponsor, Ottawa. You can still get in their Midwest Morel Mushroom Hunt and Festival. It's all happening May 3rd. And it's in memory of this guy out that way who was the morel mushroom finder and educator. Everybody knew him and loved him. And he would lead these people on these guided morel mushroom hunts. Tom Nauman has passed away, but the hunt goes on. So they've set aside land. It's the Midwest Morel Mushroom Fest. You meet in Ottawa, and then they put you on little buses, and they take you out about 10 minutes outside of town. It does sell out, and if that sounds at all interesting to you, an ice walk in the park and looking for the mushrooms, click on visitottawail.com. It's brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, back to the Rascals. We've talked about teen takeovers, where students via social media hear about a large gathering, and then when they show up, it becomes unruly and intimidating and dangerous. We see more of these as the weather gets warmer. One visitor to our city was shot at one of these last month. While the idea of lowering the curfew from 10 p.m. to 8 o'clock has been floated, that idea was averted today in the city council with this. The police can apply pop-up curfews. They can simply declare one for a specific area when and where they think it's needed. The police superintendent and one of the aldermen, Brian Hopkins, hatched the plan. It's not in force yet, but do you like that idea? So if they hear about a teen takeover is going to be over by the Bean or over by the movie theater, River East, they can simply say, okay, there's a quarantine in place for that. And it could have been launched moments or hours before that actual deadline. Anybody that would be in that area might not know about it in advance, but the police can declare it a hot zone and they can treat it as a violation if people under the age of 18 are there. Do we like that idea?
I mean, how much notice would people get? Because, like, what if I'm, you mentioned AMC River East as an example. What if I'm in the movies and it's a really long movie? Let's say it's 3 hours and 30 minutes. And all of a sudden, I get out and I'm in trouble because I'm past curfew.
I think.
Well, how was I supposed to predict that? I would like to know if they give like a certain number of advance notice or how that would exactly work.
How would you? Yeah, and even if they were to give out advance notice, how do you find out they're in the movie theater? I think when you walk out, Brandon, they'll say, "Hey, curfew, scram." I don't know. I don't know how it would play out, but I think that's 100% legit question.
Well, my guess is that they would use some discretion about arresting people who are walking out of a movie theater and, you know, groups of two and three looking peaceful. My guess is that this is just an effort to give police a tool that they would need to control certain circumstances. It does seem like it's worth a try. And all the research that I have read about curfews in general suggests that they're not that effective. But I can imagine with a targeted curfew at a targeted area, to respond to an actual emerging situation, that it could be effective. It might actually be a great way to start addressing this problem. Apparently last weekend, there were 4 teen trends that were scheduled, you know, on social media. There were word was going around, and the police were able to stop 3 of them by showing up in force and shooing the kids away. I guess they failed to stop the one by Kate's house, right, Kate?
That is correct. I think everybody admitted that the Friday night one that was anticipated at the Bean just fizzled out because it was a cold night. Didn't happen. I know in Hyde Park, they're kind of like bragging about the fact that they broke up the teen trend. I would call it a takeover. I don't think it's fair to call them trends necessarily. I don't know. Sometimes, obviously, if they're peaceful, then they can be a trend. But it wasn't very big, so they're kind of, I think, taking a little too much credit for breaking up what happened in Hyde Park. In Hyde Park, there were probably no more than 50 kids, and we're talking about a stretch of 53rd Street where they were probably concentrated. They seem to have been concentrated from everything I've read along basically the 2 blocks that are the main downtown drag for Hyde Park, and they had 100 cops. So, you know, not that hard, I think. And even so, they started gathering around 7 o'clock by some accounts, 8 o'clock by other accounts. And the police started asking people to break it up around 9 o'clock in anticipation of the 10 o'clock curfew. And instead of breaking anything up, that's when all the scuffling started. And that resulted in a couple of arrests of 15-year-old boys. There was a scuffle in front of a Sweet Green restaurant right around the corner. This is an area, I might add, that is already The store owners are already very nervous because there was a shooting, I think, was it last summer or the summer before? They're all still very nervous about that shooting. 53rd Street has taken a long time to get to the point where it is now, where it is a very vibrant place with a lot of restaurants. And that did not used to be the case. I've been here since 1980, and I can tell you, it's taken a long time to get there. And for people, for restaurants to have outside seating, et cetera, they need to have customers feel confident that they're not going to get caught in a mob of teenagers that could end up with random shooting.
Thought it was interesting. Laura Washington in the Tribune today had an op-ed, and she said, where are the parents? She said, we need to talk to the parents, communicate with the parents, hold the parents responsible. This is a parent problem. And I think that's true, but to me, you're just whistling in the wind with that. I don't know that wagging your finger at or threatening the parents is going to do much. She did quote Mayor Brandon Johnson, who said, when asked about the earlier hour for the curfews, I haven't really thought much about curfews, to be honest with you. I think I spend more time thinking about how we actually can invest in young people and create more healthy, safe spaces for them to be able to, you know, exercise to their heart's desire and do it in a constructive way.
I don't think Brandon Johnson understands why these kids, I mean, get together and do, I mean, they get together in places downtown. They want to cause some trouble. It's like, oh, they just want a rec center where they can play ping pong and volleyball and dodgeball. No, they're gathering downtown in places where it's high profile, and they're looking to cause some trouble, to draw attention to themselves. I mean, I feel like it's a category error that Johnson makes. I don't understand. He's got young kids. He understands this. He must. But he's acting like, oh, these kids, they just don't have anything to do. That's not the case.
Kids don't are not looking to be supervised. I don't blame them. Who wants to be supervised? That's not what you're looking for as a teenager at night in the summer. This idea of the basically a pop-up curfew, I mean, I understand why they came up with it, because Brandon Johnson is blocking the possibility of the lower curfew downtown.
Yeah.
So I understand why they're trying to come up with other things. But, I mean, this is basically contrary to the basic rule of law, which it, in a democracy where you know what the rules are, so you know what's allowed and not allowed. It's literally like in 1984, where Winston goes to write in his diary, and he knows that it's not illegal because nothing is illegal anymore. And yet he knows he could get sent to jail for maybe 25 years just for writing in a diary. It's not written down anywhere. You never know when something's going to be illegal.
Wow.
You just have to, which obviously, okay, I know that's not what they're going for, but it's never good if a potential rule, law, really kind of sounds like 1984.
You know what feels Orwellian to me lately is the idea of putting speed cameras on Lakeshore Drive connected to artificial intelligence that will see how you're driving. And if the computer determines that your driving was sufficiently dangerous, then you get a ticket. No human being interaction at all.
The thing about this pop-up curfew thing is Ed Yonka from the Illinois ACLU pointed out that it is absolutely going to be drawing all kinds of expensive court challenges, whereas a two-hour earlier curfew downtown, that's trotting legal ground that they're used to. It's a curfew. That's not something, that's not some whole new precedent. While I totally understand Mayor Johnson saying that he doesn't want to see it just get see things get pushed out to other neighborhoods, I mean, I get that. I was just a block away from this week's teen takeover instead of downtown. At the same time, downtown is uniquely attractive for these. We know that. This is where the worst takeovers have happened, with shootings every time it's happened this year. And downtown is in a bad way right now. People don't want to live downtown. People don't want to go downtown for cultural things that they think they're going to be caught in mob actions with random shootings.
Which is just so sad because the downtown is still safe. It's still beautiful. It's still a great city. I know what we've been talking about here, and those things have happened, but we're talking about a lot of people over a lot of space over a long time. And it's if you thinking listening to this podcast, well, I'm not going to go downtown and risk sitting outside and eating at a restaurant or going to a movie, I'm sorry for your loss, because you're really missing out on one of the great experiences in America, and that is the city of Chicago, and the city of Chicago when it's blooming like it is.
Let me propose an innovative idea that may be a solution to this, because I do think inherently the problem and the reason why we have these teen trends is that there are not enough things that these teens would like to do as provided to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think about when I was a kid. You know what I like to do? Me and my friends like to go to the mall or go to Walmart or go wherever and play Pac-Man or do all these little games. And yeah, it would bother people in the store. Absolutely. But we just wanted something. There was nothing else to do. So what if we actually get a teen who is really smart, and we appoint them in the city to help find solutions and activities for things that teens actually want to do? Because Kate makes a great point. Teens don't really care much for supervision. They don't really care for, you know, a basketball court or all that type of stuff. What do they care for? Let's hear from them and find out. And maybe we see these teen trends kind of dissipate or disappear. I think ultimately, too, I think the city and public officials and the police have to be careful the line they tread with this, because the majority of the kids that go to these teen trends are not causing trouble. And the majority of the kids that do go to these things, they are just hanging out with friends. It's unfortunate, though, you got one or two, three or four bad eggs that ruin it for everybody else. How do we make it to where we can have a safe time for these kids to enjoy the downtown and Hyde Park and other spaces, and making sure that chaos doesn't happen, and also avoiding unnecessary police interactions that escalate into something worse? There's a tough line to thread here, but I think you got to bring these teenagers to the table,
right,
to try to find those solutions. That's my innovative idea. We'll see if it ever happens.
I like the idea of bringing teens into the conversation very much. I don't think that you're going to see a lot of kids arrested and charged. You might see them handcuffed and put into wagons and taken away from the scene. But I think this is just simply a tool that the police and the city feel like they need to break up these events without, you know, to be able to say, look, you're breaking the law now. We're getting you out of here before trouble actually starts. I hope so. And that's why I think this is worth a try. I haven't seen the ordinance. Maybe they could do like a one summer long pilot program. They seem to like pilot programs in the city, to see how it works, to see if the police are abusing their authority, if you're getting sued by the ACLU and others. But I really do like Brandon's idea of bringing some of these kids who are part of this into the conversation and say, well, look, what can we do to provide you with what you are looking for when you're gathering in Millennium Park and going through the streets and jumping on top of cars?
Yeah, it's maybe better than the alternative of nothing at all. You know, at 8 o'clock in the evening, it's still bright light and warm in the city. And if you are issuing a blanket curfew at 8 o'clock on all of the unsupervised youth in the city under the age of 18, that's a big ask. So maybe these just micro curfews would be worth a try, Eric.
The 8 o'clock curfew is just for downtown. Very few teenagers actually live downtown. So, you know, if you leave downtown around 8 o'clock, then you're going to get home by your 10 o'clock citywide curfew, which is unfortunately not a bad idea safety-wise for the teens. So it's not forcing them to be inside at 8 o'clock. It's forcing them, if it's actually used, when it's actually used, it's forcing them to start going home, start going to your safe places. The idea was never to have it be a blanket curfew, but something for them to draw upon when they needed, when there were unruly groups of kids. And it's the kids who suffer most from the situation that we have right now. it's because of what's been going on that teenagers can't just go to a movie at the AMC River East Theater anymore. They have to be accompanied by an adult.
You're right. This is also, whether they know it or like it or not, this protects them too from some of that violence as well. Let's talk briefly about the Illinois House Bill 2827, the homeschooling bill. We've talked about it on the radio before. This isn't a law yet. It's popular among some people in Springfield, and it's not popular among some people in Springfield, but it would establish certain criteria that you would have to meet in order to homeschool your kids. And Illinois is remarkably lax about this sort of thing. The bill would say, for instance, that if you're going to teach your kids at home, you have to have a high school diploma. If you're going to interact with kids outside school, we need to make sure that they've got their vaccines up to snuff. Let's make sure that at least the basics are being taught at home. None of the requirements struck me as being something that was unreasonable or too invasive. If a family wants to teach their kid at home, they have the right to do so. Not exactly sure why you want to do that, but if that's the way you want to go, fine. But I don't think the state is asking too much. And yet we talked to a downstate legislator who just could not say enough bad things about it. And Brandon, you told us before we went on the pod today that you, for a period of time, were homeschooled. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. Proud product of homeschooling to a degree. I stopped doing homeschool like middle school into high school. So I find this whole conversation interesting because I feel like the requirements that they're asking with this bill for the state of Illinois are not out of the realm of reasonability. When you look at homeschooling across the country, more than 39 states require some form of notification to the state that you're going to be homeschooling your child, or you're pulling them out of the district. And many of them are Midwest states, including Wisconsin, including Ohio. And really, it's the bare minimum, I would think, to let the state know, hey, here is my child. I'm going to take over their education. They exist. We're going to meet the standards and so on and so forth. It's a form. So the pushback on this bill is fascinating to me. Because I just don't think it's that unreasonable of an ask. It's something that I think is long overdue, honestly. Of course you're going to want to make sure that children are tracked and making sure they don't fall through the tracks in the education system.
Yeah, I was surprised at the vehemence of the opposition to it. It was the attitude of the opposition that really surprised me. One of the main things that people objected to was that the form that the parents will fill out for their homeschooled child. Minimum requirements were listed, but it did not specify, you know, this is all that could be included. So in other words, they were afraid that this form was going to expand to include just a lot of extra personal information that they didn't want to give. But the whole attitude of the opposition has not just been, let's tweak this bill and make it reasonable. It's been, don't do anything. It's absolute overreach to ask us even for a piece of paper with our child's name, address, age, and sex. I really don't see why that information is a problem, but even just providing that basic information is being considered an invasion of privacy. This is all based off of a ProPublica investigation with another nonprofit group called Capital News that happened last year that went over some really sad cases of kids who fell through the cracks, who were not being homes, who were not going to school, were pulled out. At this point, there are 38 states that do have some regulations. Illinois has zero, just absolute zero. So your kid doesn't go back to school. You don't have to give any reasons. You don't even have to tell them. One child in Rockford in particular got shot at home, apparently from a gun that was in the household. There were five other kids in that household, even younger than him. He wasn't found for 7 months because he's being homeschooled and no one even knew who he was, what was going on with him. So it's ripe for abuse. It needs to have a little oversight, even though most of the homeschoolers, I'm sure, are doing great, especially when we consider how bad our regular schools are doing in only the 30th percentile for fourth graders at reading and maybe up to around the 40th percentile for math.
Isn't there some paranoia that kicks in here? It's the same kind of paranoia that attaches to people who don't want any information at all about your gun purchases or gun ownership to be known by the state. That there's this feeling like if they know I'm homeschooling my kid, next thing you know, they're going to come into my house and take my kids away. And I don't know. It just, I would like to know from John, though, what he felt the best argument was from this downstate lawmaker who was opposed to the legislation.
Well, he cited how badly kids perform in Chicago public schools and said kids that are homeschooled do a lot better than the state average or the city average. And I did see a statistic that said that Brandon, children of color who are homeschooled, black kids that are homeschooled do much better than children who are the black kids that go to public schools. If the schools are underperforming and a parent is concerned enough about that, that they take them into their own home, well, that's a parent who really cares about the kid's education.
Absolutely. I think there can be, it's all situational. There could be great benefit to a family to have homeschooling, depending on the parent's expertise, concerns about the school district, and so on and so forth. And so I'm not surprised to hear that either. But also on the other end, I'm sure that like Kate pointed to, there's cases of students who don't go to school and don't have to report and there's no way to track. And then those kids grow up and they can't read, they can't write, they can't do math, they can't critically think. And then we have the country we do. So, you know, we have to have this benchmark of something, right? Of just like, we acknowledge that these children exist and that we as a state have a responsibility to make sure that they are at least at the bare minimum educated to some degree. And I don't see how a form, I don't know why I'm so passionate about this. I don't see how filling out a form is such an attack on civil liberties.
What about a home inspection, Brandon? Should the school district send a representative to the home to make sure that there is a place for the kid to get educated?
Okay, now that's
not in the bill.
That can be debated, and that part I can see where people would have an issue with a home inspection, right? But the issue of just like registering and just acknowledging to the state and notifying the state, hey, I am pulling my child out of the district, out of the school, I am taking over their homeschooling, that should be no issue there. Almost every state in the country has that benchmark, and I'm surprised Illinois doesn't. Yeah. It's long overdue.
We're not talking about outlawing homeschooling here, and so I would without
or that it's even bad.
I'll stipulate what the downstate legislator said to you, John, that homeschoolers do better than kids in public school. That's irrelevant to the question of whether you want any sort of regulation or oversight into homeschool kids because of the potential for abuse that Kate talked about. So I was wondering, is there anything about the regulations? Would it be okay with this downstate lawmaker if they tweaked the regulations in some way, or is he just kind of totally against, is the opposition just totally against any kind of oversight at all?
Well, it sure did feel like a cultural argument. For details be damned. It's the Democrats in Chicago that are running the world, and they don't like them telling them how to educate their kids or what their rights and responsibilities are in central Illinois. It felt more like that. Honestly, Eric, I didn't ask him about the specific point you and Kate are talking about, but it felt like this guy wasn't going to like anything coming out of Cook County.
The representative who introduced it is from Lombard, so it's a suburb, but okay.
Yeah,
it's Chicago land. She is a Democrat. I would just point out also that from that ProPublica report, the number of students from preschool to 12th grade who had been enrolled in Illinois schools at the beginning of the pandemic through now is down by 127,000 students. They did not all go to private school. Private school enrollment also dropped. So where did they all go? We literally don't know. There were also 1,200 reports of educational neglect to DCFS from 2020 to 2023.
I'm sensitive and empathetic to the concern that this could unnecessarily criminalize parents. Mm-hmm. However, so does taxes. So do other things we have to do that you got to put your name on and say that you do it. Like it's so basic to me. I don't understand why people are so up in arms. Maybe it's a pandemic thing. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this is one of those fights where I'm like, why are people so upset about a form, of all things, a form? You look at other states, they require so much more. In other states, you have to have proof of the test you're doing. You have to have grades. You have to have a system. They're just saying, hey, we just need a form from you. And maybe an occasional portfolio of showing some education. That's really all. So, you know, I could talk about this till the cows come home. But I turned out fine for my homeschooling, and I had to be registered with the state.
The downstate lawmaker, now that I think about it, reminded us that homeschool kids do better on standardized tests than the general student population. But again, I think Eric would say, would you not, Eric, that that's sort of beside the point here. We're not saying homeschooling is bad. We're just saying that there ought to be a level of compliance, a standard, like Brandon is saying, a standard level of compliance.
Totally, totally. I would, for the sake of argument, I will stipulate that homeschool kids do better than public school kids. But that doesn't give us any information about whether it's better to have some sort of mild, sounds like fairly mild, moderate forms of regulation and oversight. That seems like just common sense. And yeah. And look how well Brandon turned out. I mean, my goodness.
Although he has an unruly beard, and I'm not sure that would have been allowed.
I also sympathize for sure with the parents. But for some reason, the opponents to this are immediately imputing these bad motives to, for instance, the representative who introduced it and anyone who supports it, imputing the bad motive that they want to shut down homeschooling, want to make it too hard for people to homeschool. And I'm not seeing any indication of that at all. And I certainly wouldn't want to make it too hard for people to homeschool either. But, you know, like Eric was saying before, that there's definitely an element of paranoia involved in this. Here's a good example of that. This bill also is requiring, for the first time apparently, for private schools to also provide lists of who their students are. So if you're not being homeschooled, then you would be registered as being a student and that you exist via your private school. And that's being promoted as a way for the state to keep a list of kids by religion. Because if you're in a parochial school, if they send a list of their students, now you know how many students are Catholic or this or that. And that definitely to me that's beginning to sound, a little paranoid.
Okay, let's do attraction or distraction. And I'm thinking about Maryland's Kilmar Abreu Garcia. He was born in 1995 in El Salvador. He moved to the United States at the age of 16. After a gang there threatened him and his family, they were going to extort business. His life was in danger, he felt. He fled to the United States and came here in 2011 without authorization. He was arrested in 2019 on immigration offenses. He has no criminal record here. He has no criminal record there, certainly none that any of us are aware of. An immigration judge ruled that he faces dire consequences if he were to be deported to El Salvador. And so he was able to continue to live in the United States. He got a work permit. He checked in with immigration every year. He got married to an American woman, a U.S. citizen. They have three kids. And then he was arrested again and sent to Louisiana. And the way that case has been going has been a real cause celeb. And I've been wondering if we are, however important that is, worrying too much about this one guy? Or is this writ large something that is more of an attraction than a distraction? Isn't it remarkable to you guys how much attention we're paying to this one case? Because it's coming at the expense of other things, like what continues to happen with the economy.
I think what you're seeing is American anxiety raised to the maximum level, because it appears we're at this apex point where the executive branch and the judicial branch are at war at the highest levels. This really revolves not so much around the man himself, but due process. Who has the right to due process, and erroneous statements and allegations versus convictions and actual days in court. I just saw that Jesse Waters said that he wears a Bulls hat, therefore it's gang related. which, okay, I guess I'm part of the gang too, if that's the case. But ultimately here, once it, if we're going after people for tattoos they're wearing, for being in a gang, which being in a gang is not a crime, what you do in the gang is, if we're going after people for allegations of things, that fundamentally changes the way American law works. And I think the fear is that it doesn't stop with Garcia himself. He's the first, but we're already seeing students on their visas deported and taken off streets for, you know, their stances on the Israel and Palestine conflict, you know, the First Amendment being tested. It's just another battle. And we're just, there's fear happening on, like, how far does this go and who is really at risk here? Is it just folks who are what they call illegal, you know, not legally here in the United States, or does it go beyond that? For, as Trump has talked about, we want to take people that have committed a crime and send them overseas. What rights do people who have actually committed a crime have here in the United States of America? And that gets to the fundamentals of our country and our Constitution. So the alarm has been raised. We had a 5-alarm fire happening right now because we are seeing in full force authoritarian actions being taken by this government. You're seeing people try to resist, but what can the courts really do when a president of the United States doesn't actually follow the court order? It's scary, that's for sure.
That was really well said, and an excellent argument for homeschooling. I mean, I think what Brandon points out is that it's not just this one case, and it is the fact that he is gone from being an undocumented person in the United States with legal permission to be here, court permission, to a prison in El Salvador. What crime has he committed in El Salvador? And the whatever that tin pot dictator who runs El Salvador seems to think, he's keeping him in prison. I guess we're paying for him to be in prison somewhere. That is very frightening. And Trump's suggestion that we're going to have prisons for people in America who are accused of crimes, American citizens who are accused of crimes without getting due process, go to prisons in foreign countries, is terrifying. I think this is it's not just a distraction.
He was just riffing. That was at a Q&A, and they said, what about other citizens? And then he said, well, if somebody hits an old lady with a baseball bat or sexually assaults an old woman, his attitude, his tone was, I don't care. Get rid of them, too. Who wants them?
I certainly agree. If somebody hits an old lady on the head with a bat or assaults them, they should be tried and put in prison for a long time, but not a prison in El Salvador, where if we discover some evidence that it wasn't that person who committed the crime, there's apparently no way to get them back. I think we are, and Brandon's actually right about the fact that we are seeing this conflict between the judicial branch and the executive branch, where the executive branch, Trump, seems to be just defying them. I mean, there was a judicial ruling that with these deportations, that people in the Trump administration are in contempt of court. And what's going to happen there? I think we're all looking to see, is this going to be enforceable?
They're in contempt of court.
But nose at them?
Do you worry, Eric, that you're making that mistake of taking Donald Trump seriously, but you're also taking him literally? We should take him seriously, but not literally. I have no fear that law-abiding citizens like those of us on this panel are going to be rounded up and thrown in a prison in El Salvador. Do you?
I have some fear that they're going to do things like at the border when you're coming back from another country. They're going to ask for your phone. They're going to search your phone for anti-Trump statements. This is something that Mona Charon wrote about in The Bulwark recently, where she talks about that people who are coming in from other countries who are American citizens are having their phones searched by TSA because it's a crime to criticize dear leader. I think that the idea, just don't take Trump literally. Maybe that was Trump 1.0, but Trump 2.0 seems to be when he says things like, you know, we're going to, I mean, I take him seriously that he's going to maybe try to annex Canada, that he's going to try to annex Greenland, that he's going to go down and wage war in the Panama Canal. I don't think this is just idle talk anymore. Look at the things that he talked about doing, this raising the tariffs. I mean, to get into another subject where he's raised the tariff on China to 145%, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, when he starts talking about things, they have this tendency to happen these days. I mean, I don't think that we can just laugh off Trump as a blowhard anymore, because he seems to say things and then they suit the action to the word.
I think it's not just a distraction also, not surprisingly. It's very much the main attraction right now, because he's not just one person in that he represents a whole class of people who are being plucked off the street, not given due process before they're deported. And it's really astonishing how the Trump administration continues to just get worse and worse.
I know.
At
every day, they're angry at or doing something that they know is going to just so upset people. We don't get a break. We do not get a break.
But what astonishes me is how they can take something that should be resoundingly popular and make it a constitutional crisis between the judicial branch and the executive branch.
What's resoundingly popular?
There's almost nobody who would not be happy to deport illegal immigrants who are criminals or gang members.
Right.
But we expect these people to have due process. First, show that they deserve to be deported for whatever reason. Then talk about deporting them. But you can't just pluck even someone who is an illegal immigrant off the street and deport them with nothing more. You know, yes, a whole plane load of people, of course, have been sent to that prison, not just Mr. Garcia. He's a specific person where, you know, it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court now. If they can force this through, hopefully everyone else will be able to get their due process via him.
You wonder, Kate, don't you, what do they have on this guy? Because you're right, we haven't seen the evidence. It's all of these charges against him that he's a human trafficker and that he's in a gang. I thought Brandon made an interesting point, although if that gang's considered a terrorist organization, maybe it is unlawful to be in that gang. But in general, you could be in a gang. We might not like that, but I don't think that gets you thrown in jail. I also wonder, when you're in a gang, what does that even mean? What is the crime that you have committed? And here's the point I'm trying to make.
Sure.
You would almost hope then that they really do have the goods on this guy if he's going to be the name and the face of this activity. He's the exemplar. And so what have you got on him? And it's starting to sound like they got the wrong guy. If you want to find somebody who's really bad, get somebody who did commit a crime. Use that guy as the example. Not this guy, because the case against him, for all we know, this is just all we know, is very weak, if existent at all.
And of course, the Trump administration didn't really pick him. He's been elevated because his family has, you know, been able to bring this suit and pursue it.
But they could have taken a pass. They could have said what the...
They could have actually admitted they made a mistake. But, you know, that's not what Trump does. This is not what he was taught by Roy Cohn. You are supposed to never admit a mistake. Ever, ever, ever. I do begin to think also, though, that the way they are purposely plucking people up without due process and deporting them is perhaps to some extent, just to sow fear among others cause a lot of people to self-deport.
And that is working.
I think a lot of it is working. Probably for show,
Eric, how do you read Stephen Miller saying, and the president and Marco Rubio, for that matter, all nodding their head in agreement, that U.S. Supreme Court decision 9-0 was in fact in favor of the Trump administration handling of this case?
It was nuanced, wasn't it? The decision, it wasn't just bring him back now, no questions asked. They were talking about facilitating the return and so on. But I think they're misrepresenting that decision, and I think that they are misrepresenting the evidence that they have against Garcia. That the State Department has even admitted that they made a mistake with him. And so, and then they're talking about, well, if he comes back, we're going to deport him right away anyway. I think that just shows such a disrespect for the rule of law, disrespect for the courts, that is just the beginning of what we're going to start seeing more and more of. And this is why, you know, I really wanted to underscore what Brandon said earlier, which is that when they get away with this, then they can start saying, well, you know, that criticizing the Trump administration is a danger to our country, because that's kind of the rationale they're using against people who are demonstrating in favor of the Palestinians and the against Israel. They're saying, well, if you are anti-Zionist, you are anti-Semitic, and you are critical of the Trump administration, you're a danger to this country. We're getting rid of you. That may sound alarmist. May sound like people will say, well, that's Trump derangement syndrome, but. It just seems to me that so many of the things that we are seeing these days are examples of Trump's rhetoric being turned into reality. And his rhetoric is very scary, and the reality will also be scary. So I think it's time to fight back in court, and for the public, I hope, to get a measure of this man and to say that we're not going to stand for it. They're going to let their lawmakers know and Congress, and will finally realize that they do have power here, that Republicans don't have to all fall in line behind Trump, that Congress can, for instance, take over its constitutional authority on tariffs and not let Trump get away with declaring emergencies to take control of that situation. So I think we are at a pretty pivotal point right now in our history, and that we have to take these things seriously, that we can't just say, oh, that's just a distraction.
That's Eric Zorn. Kate Plies is here, too. Brandon Pope had to click out. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. Eric, I miss your pretty face. We weren't able to see it today on this Zoom setup today.
I put on makeup and everything.
Yeah. What was your background?
I was going to ask that. What's the Zorn background we've been denied today?
You'll see it next week. It's a really great skyline of the city.
Amen to that. All right. Okay. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you next week then.
All right. Bye. I don't know why I bothered waving. You can't see me. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.